Yeah, there are three chalukot that occur in the book of Yoshua. Chalukah number one is the division of lands amongst the tribes, where Reuben, etc., where that's chalukah number one. Chalukah number two is the allocation of 48 cities of Levi'im. Remember, the tribe of Levi did not have a distinct tribal inheritance, but they have 48 Orei Levi'im that are dispersed among all of the 12 tribes. And on one level, this is said to be a good thing, because essentially Shevet Levi, which represents the spiritual teachers of the Jewish people, are dispersed amongst all the tribes. On the other hand, there's a downside implication, because if you'll recall, Shimon and Levi were the two brothers who were instrumental into the Shechem massacre. We just read about it in last week's Torah reading. And Yaakov curses Shimon and Levi, or doesn't curse them, but he curses their anger at the end of the book of Genesis, and he says, may they always be divided and dispersed. Now we know that Shimon also was dispersed, in the sense that Shimon's cities were all located within the boundaries of Yehuda. So the question becomes, well, gee, Shimon and Levi are kind of the co-conspirators here. Is the institution of Orei Levi'im to indicate the need for a spiritual influence that permeates all the 12 tribes? Or is it analogous to Shimon's disbursement or dispersal, which is meant to say they should never be concentrated to be able to engage in nefarious schemes? So there's kind of a double-edged sword in terms of what the implication of that is. Now, the Levites, in turn, are divided into four groups. And this is clearly based on the Torah's division. Group number one are called Kohanim. And sometimes people get mixed up, but remember the obvious, really. Every single Kohen is a member of the tribe of Levi. Although they're called Kohanim, right? Because basically, how does it work? Levi had three children. Gershon, Kahat, Merari. Actually, I should say three sons, because Yocheved is considered is a daughter of Levi. So Gershon, Kahat, Merari. Kahat had four sons. Amram, Yitzhar, Chevron, and Uziel. Yitzhar had one son who was very well known, and that is Korach. And Amram had three children who are very well known, Aaron, Moshe, and Miriam. Now that means, just to get this straight, that Moshe is Korach's first cousin. See, because Korach comes from Yitzhar, and Moshe comes from Amram. Now Moshe and Aaron are brothers, but Aaron became a Kohen, and Moshe remained a Levi. Right, so if you can ask, how can you have two brothers who have the same father, and one is a Kohen and one is a Levi? Answer, that was Moshe and Aaron, right? They both had that. And how can you have a Kohen whose father was not a Kohen? Answer, Aaron. Aaron's father was not a Kohen because Aaron was the first Kohen. Okay, so the group of Shevet Levi, therefore, is divided up into four groups. There is the group of Kohanim, and then there is the remainder of Kahat, the sub-tribe of Gershon, and the sub-tribe of Merari. If you recall, in the desert, these three groups of Levi'im were given distinct missions. Kahats, other than the Kohanim, were given the job of carrying the ark and carrying the altar. And Gershon carried the curtains and the tapestries of the Mishkan. And Merari did the heavy stuff, the boards and the wood and the bases and the sockets. Now, these distinct functions in the Midbar didn't really have a carryover effect once they get to the land of Israel, because the Mishkan is no longer being transported from place to place. You see, in other words, the function of Kahat, the function of Gershon, the function of Merari, these were relevant functions in the desert where the tabernacle was being carried from place to place. They did not have a particular utility once they got to the land of Israel. Of course, until the temple is built, things are still being moved occasionally, but they tended to be very set. So, for example, the Mishkan right now is in Shiloh, and it's going to remain there for 300 years. So the moving isn't that often. You know, every few hundred years or something, they they moved. But nevertheless, the family distinction was maintained even after they came to Eretz Yisrael. And as you would imagine, Kahat were like the Brahmins of the Levian, because they were the most honored class. Number one, the Kohanim came from Kahat. And number two, Kahat were the ones that carried the Ark, etc. So they still had a certain level of importance. Yep, sir.
Wait, no, I was just going to ask. You said there were three kahuvot, and is the division of the division of the Levites the third one?
I didn't mention the third one. The third one is Jeremy Klatt. I didn't mention that yet. Yeah, just digressed on the second one.
Okay.
Now, the issue is this. If you look carefully at the dispersal of the Levite cities, you will in fact see that every single tribe had... of course, had between 3 and 4, because 12 divided by 48 divided by 12 is 4, but some have a little uneven. But no tribe had less than 3 Levite cities, and most tribes had 4 or more Levite cities. So there was indeed an idea that every single tribe should, number one, contribute to the economic well-being of the Levite class, and number two, that they should have be within the sphere of influence of the Levian. It is also true that this brings me to the third division, and that was the 6 Arei Miklat. That 3 Arei Miklat were east of the Jordan, and 3 Arei Miklat were west of the Jordan. But if you compare the 6 Arei Miklat, you will see that all 6 of them are among the Levite cities. In other words, of the 48 Levite cities, 6 of them were Arei Miklat. In other words, the Ir Miklat was a Levite city. And it's been explained that this represents the idea, kind of a theory of penology, a theory of arrest. And that is, you know, one of the problems with the prison system that we have is you take someone and you put them in an environment which is filled with people who have committed crimes. You take, say, a 21-year-old person, and you put him in an environment where the only influences he's going to have are those who commit crimes. And that's why the recidivism rate is so great and the like. Now, the Torah's theory of arrest, and Ir Miklat is somewhat of a house arrest, it's not really an arrest, and you have access to the whole city, is that instead of putting people who are guilty of negligence together with criminals, you put them in an environment in which it is conducive to rehabilitation and good and beneficial influences. And that is the concept of the use of the penitentiary as a vehicle of education, as a vehicle of penitence. In fact, the word penitentiary comes from penitence, which is tshuva. The concept was give the person time to think. Rehabilitation. Now, obviously, we're not talking about rehabilitating violent offenders, because the Ir Miklat is not designed for intentional violent offenders. But there is an aspect of rehabilitation for those whose attitude towards life was callous and negligence and careless. Remember, we don't take the position. People sometimes misunderstand. People think the Ir Miklat is simply to protect the murderer. That is true, but that is not the only reason. The Ir Miklat is also designed to be a penance and a punishment and a rehabilitation. Because killing a life inadvertently through carelessness or negligence is considered to be an aveira, which needs kapara. And in fact, if it's a truly unavoidable accident, one does not even go to the Ir Miklat. There are actually 3 levels of homicide in the Torah. There is intentional homicide, which is punishable by death. There is careless, negligent homicide, for which one goes to the Ir Miklat. And then there is the truly unavoidable accident, which is not there at all. So why should one go to the Ir Miklat? So the Ir Miklat is not does not cover the person who is without fault totally. It covers the person who is, you know, you're shooting your gun in the forest, thinking no one's there, and someone gets shot. You know, that's an Ir Miklat, because you know one does not discharge guns if somebody might be around, right? So It is what we would call in the legal system manslaughter, right? Manslaughter is the killing of a human being not with actual intention or malice aforethought, but with some type of negligence or carelessness.
So what about the how would you feel about the unavoidable accident?
Well, here is the thing. The Goel Hadam is not allowed to take the law into his own hands if it is an unavoidable accident. Now the question you'll raise is, okay, but the Goel Hadam might do it anyway. Well, the Ir Miklat is not designed to simply protect people against unjustified violence. For that we tell the person, hire your security guard. The Ir Miklat is designed to protect when the Goel Hadam is given the halachic prerogative to be a vigilante. And since the Goel Hadam is given this halachic prerogative only if there's carelessness or negligence, the Ir Miklat kicks in only under those circumstances. Now, that is why, by the way, the Goel Hadam's prerogatives only start when there's an adjudication. Meaning to say, the way it works is, when a person is either arrested for committing murder or turns himself in, the first thing is he immediately goes to the Ir Miklat. And that's where he awaits trial. There is then a trial, right? So the Ir Miklat is the pre-judgment place where you go. There is then a trial. And in the trial, there can be a number of outcomes. He could be found innocent, in which case he goes home. Now, you understand, you could still raise your question there. Well, what if the Goel Hadam is convinced? Like an O.J. Simpson thing, he's convinced that he's guilty. Well, that's going to be a risk a person takes, but if he's innocent, we send him home.
What if the people home think he's not innocent, they're going to kill him?
Well, that's what I'm saying. There's going to be that risk, but nevertheless... I mean, sometimes it's your safety is more compromised if you're innocent than if you're found innocent than if you're found guilty. If he's found guilty of a capital crime, he can be executed. If he is found guilty of negligent homicide, he will be sent back to the Ir Miklat. If it is found that this is an accident for which he could not be held responsible, that would be the same as acquittal. And once again, he would go home. So, the idea that the Goel Hadam has the right to act, it's interesting. If he is convicted of intentional homicide and is sentenced to death, the Goel Hadam is an executor, if he so desires. If the person is found to be negligent and sentenced to the Ir Miklat, the Goel Hadam has the halachic prerogative to try to get him if he's not in the Ir Miklat, but once he's in the Ir Miklat, he's safe. Right? So that's where the Ir Miklat covers. So the Ir Miklat does protect only the rotseach that is a negligent homicide person, and not if it's either intentional or if it's totally unavoidable accident.
What is Goel Hadam?
Okay, the word Goel is redeemer, like we talk about Geula. So Goel Hadam, Hadam is the second word, the redeemer of the blood. Meaning it's a phrase that talks about if blood was spilled, right, just like God tells Cain, the blood is crying from the ground. So the blood, as it were, cries to be avenged. At least that's the image that we have. And the Redeemer is the one that brings repose to the blood by killing the murderer.
So is that the family of murder?
So usually that is a family member. In fact, I shouldn't say usually, it is defined as the closest family member who wants to take on that responsibility. Mm-hmm. Now, we're not saying there's a mitzvah for the Goel Hadam to do this. We're just saying that the Goel Hadam, understandably, might act in this way, and the Ir Miklat was a form of protective custody. But what's interesting is, as I say, all six of the Ir Miklat are amongst the 48 cities of the Leviim. And the Gemara mentions that there used to be a lot of signs to these cities, so in case a person was a rotseach, he would be able to get his directions. You don't want to be lost. I mean, you can imagine. Actually, unfortunately, a graphic example of what happens if you take the wrong turn and being prone to violence happens in Israel today. Every day, people take this wrong turn down the street, and they're in Palestinian-occupied territory. Well, in a similar way, if you're a rotseach and the Goel Hadam is after you, you don't want to make too many wrong turns. You want to be able to know where you have to go. Yeah.
What useful purpose is there in allowing Goel Hadam to kill someone who didn't intend to do this?
Well, there is the idea, once again, that negligence murder is considered to be a form of murder. The court is not going to sentence you, but on the other hand, on one level, a person may deserve to die for that. And therefore, until you take advantage of the protection that you're given, and galut is considered to be a form of death, that's also the idea, you are considered to be vulnerable. Taking of a life is something that's so serious that if there was negligence or culpability, a person's life might be forfeit. Well, there's actually an argument whether Baal Adam is simply given the permission, or it might actually be a mitzvah for him to do so. We rule that it's not a mitzvah, but it's just it's kind of a concession on some level to the uncontrollable desire for vengeance that may sometimes exist.
Don't the Adams do that now?
With the blood feud to the left?
Yeah,
but I do want to say this. It is hard to understand because, again, we rebel instinctively, I think, against vigilantism and the like. But I think the one thing to do keep in mind, which I think makes it easier to understand, is that there has to be an adjudication by a court first. Meaning to say, if the Baal Adam kills somebody before a court has made the judgment that, number one, he committed the act, and number two, he was negligent in committing the act, without those two findings, the Baal Adam is a murderer. It's only the existence of that judicial decision that gives the Baal Adam a certain amount of license. So just because I think that somebody did something to my family, I would not be given the prerogatives of the Baal Adam. I should also emphasize, too, that this is to be distinguished from the law of Rodef. Now, again, it's very important that you understand the difference. Rodef, which means pursuer, that is the law that says that if I see somebody who is about to kill someone, I am allowed to disable him. If I could do it by maiming or some other means, I should do it that way. But if the only way I could prevent the murder is by killing, I am allowed to apply lethal force to prevent a murder from taking place. And not only if he's threatening me, which is my right of self-defense, but even if he's threatening a third party. But Rodef is trying to stop the murder before it takes place. Once the murder has taken place, then it is only the court that can adjudicate that level of culpability, although the Baal Adam can step in once the court has decided, right? So you do have to distinguish between preventing the crime before the fact and taking vengeance after the fact.
Any kind of information about how the population of the area collaborated plot acted, and how are they oriented to treat these murderers? For instance, in today's world, when a sex offender is released from prison, and then, you know, I guess they have to have notification with where he's going to live, if it's a sex offender,
right,
and so on. How were these, using my own terms, were these people who live in Armenian class, did they have an orientation? Were there certain rules how they needed to act towards the murderers?
Well, I think it was relatively benign, because after all, you know, we're not dealing with rapists, we're not dealing with intentional murderers, we're dealing with people who, did engage in behaviors that were careless and callous, for which they need to suffer some consequence, but, you know, they're not, you know, evil people, so to speak. So, by and large, as far as we know, they were treated relatively benign, other than they were not allowed to leave the Yer Miklat for any reason whatsoever, including death of a relative or whatever it is. They could not go to a funeral. They were there for, not their life, but they were there until the death of the Kohen Gadol, which may be, you know, one day later, maybe 50 years later. That all depended. But as far as we can see, there was no particular harshness in the way that they were treated within that environment. Remember, they were not imprisoned. I mean, they had the same access to the cities as the Leviim had. It's not clear exactly who supported them. That's an interesting question. As far as I could see, it was not like a prison where the state supported you. Basically, you had to make a living. Either you made a living or your family took care of you. So I guess the Rotschim had some type of business or occupation or whatever it is. But we don't really have a sense of the populations either, meaning to say how many Leviim were in a city versus how many Rotschim, and would it depend on a time and place. I assume that although six is not a tremendously large number, but I assume that the desire was to keep the Levi'im the predominant element of the population. You didn't want it to be a population of primarily Rotschim. Yeah.
I have a question also about what kind of information you have. Seeing how much evidence that took to convict someone, which we know, discussed that one of the classes,
yep.
It seems like it's hardly evident.
That's correct.
Then the impulse for revenge was probably very high,
mm-hmm.
Yep. Because it looked like to me that he always served justice here.
Yes.
Well,
we don't have the numbers, but you are correct. The possibility of the Beit Din ruling that somebody would be put to death was almost nil because of the need for eyewitnesses and warning and everything else. So the most common finding was either somebody was a shogeg, or somebody was a mezid. Somebody was intentional, but the technical requirements for capital punishment were not met. In both of those cases, the person is vulnerable to the Goel Hadam. But of course, in the Mezid, he does not get the benefit of the Yer Miklat, so he'd have to hire his own security guards. Which means, you're making a good point, meaning to say that the concept that the bad guys always got away was not really true in murder cases, because the rest of his life he would be worried about the Goel Hadam coming after him.
But if he wasn't found guilty?
Now, if he was found innocent, or there was no evidence to be guilty, then the Goel Hadam cannot touch him. Now, that doesn't mean the Goel Hadam won't try to kill him, but so that could itself be murder, and the Goel Hadam could be punished for that.
Oh, I was going to say, if he were let go and the Goel Hadam killed him,
yeah.
I mean, if he was let go because it was decided that it was intentional, or not intentional.
Yes.
A true accident.
Right.
Yeah. And he was let go, but the family didn't believe that, and they killed him, then his family could pursue that.
That's correct. It
what
could,
a mess.
Well, yes. It could escalate into multi-generational feuding, because a Goel Hadam that kills when he did not have the right to kill is now subject to the Goel Hadam of the family, etc. Yeah. So that could indeed go that way. And, well, you know, vengeance, all we could say is that the halacha, by providing that a Goel Hadam that acts beyond his authority has committed murder, is the best you can do. You can't stop those crimes from happening, but you can provide that there would be punishment if they do happen. Just one thought to go backwards a little bit on the three divisions of the Levites in the desert. We had the tribe or the sub-tribe of Kahat, who carried the ark, and the sub-tribe of Gershon that carried the tapestries and the wall hangings, and then Merari, which carried the boards and the kureshim, the sockets, all the heavy stuff. They carried them on wagons. It's interesting that, what is the significance of these groupings once you have a temple? Right? Why do we still even keep a record of who's who? So it's interesting that one of the great Hasidic authors, Rav Tzedek, offers the following idea, that we know that the tribe of Levi as a whole represents that portion of the Jewish people that devotes themselves exclusively to divine service. They're not to be too involved in commerce. They don't own significant portions of real estate. They are supposed to be the teachers and the scholars of the Jewish people, and thus they are supported largely by the community. In fact, it's a prototype, as it were, for the notion of the Jewish community supporting a certain segment of itself that would be occupied in the teaching of divine wisdom. In fact, the Rambam writes, Maimonides writes at the end of the Laws of Shemitah, a very interesting thing. You know, this year in Israel is the Shemitah year, the sabbatical year. And Maimonides writes that the purpose of Shemitah is to give every single Jew, at least living in agricultural society, the opportunity, as it were, to remove himself from the daily grind of making a living and to be able to devote their time to serving God and teaching Torah, learning Torah. So what Shevet Levi did all the time is what Shemitah is designed to let us do for that 1 year as like Shabbat of the week, right? Shabbat is the day of the week that allows us to experience this. Shemitah is 1 year out of seven, same parallel. In fact, Shemitah is called Shabbat Haaretz, the Shabbat of the land. They say one of the great rabbis every Shemitah would go around kissing the trees, saying, good Shabbos, good Shabbos, good Shabbos. He would wish Shabbat to the to the trees. The New York Times had a very interesting article about Shemitah a few months ago. I don't know if you saw it. Because, you know, ever since Rav Kook's time, Rav Kook was the first the chief rabbi of what was then called Palestine. Rav Kook died before the state of Israel was established. What they do in Israel, since obviously if the land could not be farmed, there would not necessarily be enough food to feed the population, they sell the land in Israel to non-Jewish farmers, to Arabs, just as we sell our chametz, therefore we don't own the chametz, and that's why we can eat it after Passover. So Rav Kook devised the idea of a pro forma sale of the land to a Gentile, to a trustworthy Arab, and since it is non-Jewish land, it was thought that it does not have the sanctity of the Shemitah year, and it could be farmed and cultivated and produce crops. So the Israeli chief rabbinate has been doing this, what is called heter mechira, dispensation by selling the land. They've been doing this for many, many years, since basically World War I, based on Rav Kook's heter. Now Rav Kook's heter is, in fact this is all in the New York Times, I mean, they wrote this up, is a very, very questionable heter in a lot of ways. Number one, are you allowed to sell land to a non-Jew in the land of Israel? Some say, many opinions say not. Number two, does the fact that it is owned by a non-Jew take off the Shemitah laws? I mean, it still may be Shemitah land, etc. So it's very, very questionable, and many opinions took the position that Rav Kook permitted it only because the alternative in those days would have been mass starvation. Today, that's less likely because of importing foods and the like. And then he say where the situation is not as dire as it was, the rationale of the heter would not apply. So thus, the what you might call the more right-wing or the more observant or whatever phrase you want to use, tend not to rely on the heter mechira in Israel. And they either have food imported from Europe and the like, or they actually try to buy Arab produce. In other words, they don't sell Jewish land to the Arabs, but stuff that is actually produced on Arab-owned land. Now, this year is a little bit of a complication because it's more difficult this year because of the uprising to do business with Arab farmers. So there actually are some shortages among those who do not rely on the heter mechira. But it's getting more complicated. The Israeli chief rabbinate has always relied on the heter, but this year in particular, there was tremendous pressure on the chief rabbis not to authorize it because they just felt it wasn't halakhically valid, and there was a lot of going back and forth, and I think the Sephardic chief rabbi at one point said that, well, he has to allow it because this is what they allow, but he promises not to eat any food that is produced from that dispensation. I think then he changed his mind on that too. Yeah.
I have a little problem with this because, I mean, obviously what raises the price of food, and I got put on the international Haaretz yesterday, the U.S. Headline was that 20% of Jews in Israel live below the poverty line, and 25% of children live below the poverty line.
Mm-hmm.
So we have to weigh that.
Yeah. Well, it is a good question, but you know, ideally, in an ideal way, and again, the laws of Shemitah are very complicated, there are things that, you know, even Jews are allowed to do, meaning if I own a field during Shemitah, I'm not allowed to plant it and the like, but if I have a fruit trees or orchards, I'm allowed to take the steps that are needed so that my fruit will not die. So there are various things that can be done, and when you do harvest that fruit must be sold only at cost. In other words, you don't make any profit off it because Shemitah fruit is supposed to be available. So on one level, Shemitah produce can actually be cheaper, not the ones that you're buying from the Arabs, but the ones that are produced on Jewish farms, although it may be less in quantity. So, you know, there are difficulties there. And some have argued, based on the Torah, that if more Jews would observe Shemitah, God would bless their crops more. If you remember, the Torah itself says that if you keep the Shemitah, God will give you double and triple in the sixth year. So it's kind of a catch-22. Since people are not keeping Shemitah, you know, the price goes up. But be it as it may, the Rambam does draw an interesting analogy that Shevet Levi lived a life that is the way that we would live during the Shemitah year in the ideal sense. Now, in serving God, we know there are three pillars to service of God. Right? Pirkei Avot says, the world stands on three pillars. Ala Torah, the study of Torah. Avodah, which is divine service, focusing on prayer and sacrifice. And the third is gemilut chasadim, loving kindness and compassion that we show others, right? Torah, avodah, gemilut chasadim. In fact, the commentaries point out that Avraham represents service of God primarily through loving kindness. That's Avraham's big thing. Yitzchak, who was a korban, represents the service of God through divine service. And Yaakov, although you don't see it in the Chumash so much, but according to rabbinic tradition, before Yaakov came to Laban's house, after 14 years in the yeshiva of Shem, Noach's son, Shem, where he studied Torah, because we don't know exactly what Torah meant then, the Torah was not given, but he studied divine wisdom in the yeshiva of Shem. Therefore, Yaakov is connected to the idea of Limud HaTorah. Torah Avodah Gemilut Chasadim. It's interesting that the Chafetz Chaim, you know, last week we read about Yaakov wrestling with the angel, and the angel smites him on the thigh. So the Chafetz Chaim raises an interesting point. Why does the angel only attack Yaakov? Why don't we find an angel that attacks Avraham or Yitzchak? Only Yaakov. So the Chafetz Chaim says the following point. He says, you know, Avraham serves God through loving kindness, and Yitzchak serves God through prayer, and Yaakov serves God through Torah study. He says, the angel of Esav, the Yetzer Hara, whatever it's symbolic of, is perfectly willing to let Jews have synagogues in which they pray, and is perfectly willing to let Jews have charitable organizations, because they know that after a few generations, it's going to peter out, and there's not going to be Jewish continuity. But Limud HaTorah is the single most important vehicle for perpetuation of Judaism. And therefore, the angel of Esav wants to be sure to undermine Limud HaTorah. He says, you can have your synagogues, and you can have your charitable organizations, as important as they are, because without concentrated study of the Torah, it's going to disappear anyway. And that's why the Chafetz Chaim says, the angel only attacks Yaakov and did not attack Avraham and Yitzchak. The Chafetz Chaim makes another point. Why did the angel hit Yaakov on the thigh? The thigh supports the body, right? Just like, so therefore like this. The angel of Esav could never take away Torah from the Jewish people. There will always be Jews who will study Torah. But he will weaken the economic base of Torah study so that those who are involved in Jewish education will be chronically underpaid and underappreciated. And therefore, that's the concept.
Why would anybody go into Jewish education?
But that's really the test, you see? I mean, listen, if somebody, if this was a job that paid millions of dollars, you wouldn't be attracted to it for sincere motives. You'd have an ulterior motive. Now, we know for sure that if you do this, you must really love it and care about it. Right? So it turns out to be a bracha in disguise, that you only get people who are sincere and devoted. But this is the curse. This is the curse. The curse of the angel of Esav is that the Torah will always be hobbling and limping along. And in fact, it's been well said, maybe it's an excuse to encourage fundraising, but it's been well said that any Torah educational endeavor that have financial problems may not be authentic, because the angel of Esav's curse was that authentic Jewish education will always be financially suffering. So if you're doing too well, it might be a sign that something's not quite right. Anyway, I'm digressing here, but I want to go back to Levi. So if we say there are three pillars, Torah, Avodah, Gemilut Chasadim, and if we say the tribe of Levi as a whole represents serving God, one can look at the subfamilies, Gershon, Kahat, Merari, as exemplifying these three different roads in the service of God. Kahat carried the Ark. The Ark is, of course, the repository of the tablets and of the Torah. So that represents the holiness of Limud HaTorah. You see? So Kahat represents the force of Torah. Then we come to Gershon. Now this is a bit subtle and a bit symbolic. Gershon carried the tapestries and the curtains. Now, if you know the way the Mishkan was built, it was wooden walls, but there was no roof. The only roof were the curtains that were put over the roof. So the curtains represent the roof. The roof is what we mean by a bayit. What makes a set of walls a bayit? A roof. The word bayit, God's home, is always associated with the idea of prayer. Thus we talk about the temple shall be a beit tefillah, a home of prayer. So consequently, those who carry the roof carry the bayit. And the bayit is the characteristic that we associate with prayer. Right? In fact, that's even why we sometimes give an excuse. Why, it's an excuse, and I'm not legitimating it. Why people talk in synagogues. You know, it's a big problem, you know. Synagogues are always noisy. But some people say in their defense, you know, when I'm in a synagogue, I'm at home. I'm in God's home. I feel at home. It's not a foreign place to me. And because I'm at home, I relax and I talk. Now, needless to say, that's not quite the proper response. But the notion of feeling, you know, this is a home, this is a place where you feel loved and cared for by God, is a very important aspect of the Beit Knesset. And therefore, Gershon, that carries the roof, carries the bayit, represents prayer. And finally, Merari had the physically most demanding job, that is, lugging around the heavy boards. That represents Gemilut Chasadim, because Gemilut Chasadim is the physical exertions that we undertake on behalf of other people. And therefore, it's interesting that these three sub-clans represent the distinct Derachim of Torah and Gemilut Chasadim. This may suggest why, even after we came to Israel, so they were no longer schlepping this stuff around anyway, the tribal divisions were still distinct, because they did represent different approaches in the service of God. Now, all of us understand that these different approaches are not to be to the exclusion of each other. That doesn't mean, you know, somebody only davens and doesn't do Gemilat Chasadim or learn Torah, or someone learns Torah and doesn't pray. I mean, obviously, you have to blend your life with all of these components, but each personality will have a dominant sphere. And this is very important in education generally. And that is, the experience is not a one-size-fit-all type of circumstance, but rather each person has uniqueness, each person has an individuality, each person has their own bents in their Judaism and how to serve God, and one has to foster that particular individuality and that particular particular niche. So, you know, I mean, it's always the problem with all educational systems of a one-size-fit-all by definition. But we try to do the best that we can within the limits of the institution. So that's the Gershon, the Kahat, and the Merari, Torah, Avodah, Gemilut, Chasadim. Okay, and again, it's pointed out that in the hierarchy, interestingly enough, Torah seems to be the highest of all, because after all, Kahat were the ones that were the most elevated, and that seems to suggest, as the Chafetz Chaim points out, that through Torah you will come to the other levels, meaning through Torah you will learn about how to serve God and how to do chesed. But if you have chesed and prayer, which is not predicated on the study of Torah, as I say, there will tend to be a lack of continuity and transmission to the next generation. And it's been pointed out, you know, in all fairness, and again, I mean, we certainly cannot sit in judgments because of the unbelievable pressures of the earlier immigrant generations. But if you consider, for example, the 19th century immigration of Jews to the United States, mainly of German descent, you will find that virtually all of their descendants are presently not that identified with the Jewish people. The 19th century saw virtually no attempts at Jewish education, although there was quite a lot of synagogue building and many, many social welfare agencies. And you basically see that, as wonderful as and important as that work was, and again, there's no denying that that is extremely important work, after one, two, three, or four generations, they disappeared from the scene. It is only, you know, the emphasis on Jewish education is basically, I would actually say, probably it's a post-World War II phenomenon in the United States. And only then do you really see a relatively struggle of the Jewish religious life. So it is borne out that when you don't predicate continuity on education and Torah study, there's going to be a very great difficulty in the carryover. in the transmission. Yeah.
I'm reading a book about the 19th century and Jewish choices, and one of the things it said was that the people, the German descendants, were concerned right. about how the Christians would look upon Jewish religious services, particularly mm-hmm. in New York City,
right.
and that they would come in and they would see chaos.
Yeah.
You know, people praying at their own pace,
yeah.
no orderly decorum, such as you would see in a church.
Right.
And one of their goals was to try to sort of acculturate themselves and level
that's
them
right.
out.
That's right.
They were very much looking for acceptance. In the
well, yeah, that generation were really obsessed with being totally accepted, and that's why they were so, I mean, the most embarrassing thing to them was when a Jew from Poland or Russia showed up, because the East Yidden, because they were primitive and they were uncultured and not educated. And as a result, when some of the German Jews started Jewish country clubs, because they could not get accepted in the WASP country clubs, they would have their own discriminatory policies, that we don't accept Polish Jews. So then you had Polish Jews starting their country clubs. So after all, you had these different levels of stratification as to where you could belong. It's reminiscent. I actually read that in Washington, D.C., in one of the black churches, they had a color chart. because apparently the notion was that the lighter skins you were, the more acceptable you were. And they basically had rule. I mean, one of my colleagues at the University of Maryland said that when she was a child, she remembers this. They basically had a rule that if your skin was darker than a certain tone, these were all black churches, you could not go into the black church. You know, so the discrimination is crazy.
More women who were raped during slavery.
That's the paradox. That's the paradox. This is the fundamental contradiction, because the whole theory of miscegenation, of mixing of the races, would be that it would result in a weaker race, and then they gave social priority to the products of that over the ones that were not intermixed. Yeah, the blacks.
The
yeah, not the whites. But
the other
yeah.
thing this chapter said, Rabbi, was that the fact that women were separated and they were often upstairs, like in
yeah.
Sheriff Israel,
right.
in New York,
right.
that the Christians who would come to, and they used original quotes from sources, some of the Christians
yeah.
who came to the service, would observe these women, you know, upstairs, and they talked about them as being oriental beauties and representing a harem, so they sort of ascribed sexual interest to them, which made these people very uncomfortable. Whereas in the churches, the women sat with families in pews, and
yeah.
you know, it was more accepted. So
yeah, well,
it is,
and you know, in the dearth of certainly in the 19th century, the dearth of rabbinic leadership was absolutely staggering. It really was a very, very empty. There were, you know, and of course, even in the Civil War, there's a little bit of controversy, because there were some Southern rabbis who were actually very outspoken in favor of slavery. They claimed it was biblically supported. There were a few rabbis who spoke out against it, but you know, it's a very, very mixed record. I mean, the rabbis that were, many of them did not have ordination anyway. I mean, they were not rabbis. They knew more than a little bit more than some of the congregants, so they became the rabbis of their congregations. Okay, but the point is this: we do see that to the extent, of course, there's a long way to go, but to the extent that Jewish life is a bit richer than it was, I think it's largely because of the emphasis on Jewish education. That has been really the basis of success. So the Chafetz Chaim's words, which he uttered around the beginning of the 20th century, are somewhat prophetic in terms of how do you ensure the continuity of the Jewish people. You know, without that, I mean, this is really, I mean, I don't want to get into politics, but this is the issue with Birthright Israel. As you know, there's a major, major division of opinion among the communities, whether it's the Panacea program or it's not going to do that much. Because historically, if you factor out Jewish education, the two big ways of fostering Jewish identity were the Holocaust and the State of Israel. And frankly, as important as both of them are, they don't have the same drawing power as they used to. The Holocaust was basically saying, well, you got to be Jewish because Jews have been victimized and tortured and persecuted and destroyed, and how could you turn your back on this? But the truth is that after a while, kids sometimes feel, well, you know, why do I have to be part of this persecuted race? Let me, you know, not be persecuted. And Israel too. You know, Israel, of course, is a tremendous source of pride, but with all of the moral conundrums that are going on, people feel, well, you know, gee, is this such a glorious, to use a Protestant metaphor, city on a hill? Anymore, and you know, there are a lot of problems with that, and don't know if many of you have read the Hazzoni book about the Jewish states, which talks about post-Zionism and the fact that he feels virtually most of the intelligentsia in Israel is against the idea of a distinctively Jewish state. He blames it on Martin Buber, of all people. He says Martin Buber like ruined the whole thing. But I think Martin Buber's taking too much of a rap for it. But nevertheless, it does reflect the great ambivalence. There's really a tremendous ambivalence right now, which is only getting worse, regarding, well, should we have a Jewish state, or is that racist? Is that exclusionary? There's some talk about abolishing the Hatikva, putting the Muslim crescent next to the Jewish star to have a job, maybe removing any overt symbol. The buzzwords are, Israel should be a state of its citizens. And after all, Arabs are, you know, many Arabs are citizens of the state of Israel, so why should it be called a Jewish state at all? And, you know, as Americans, we could get very easily confused, too, because after all, we do believe in separation of church and state and everything else. So the point is, again, I'm not going to address this, but the point is that a lot of the classic books that gave people Jewish pride and Jewish identity, I think we find are a bit, I don't want to say disintegrating, but at least they're less powerful, they're less potent than they once were. And that would highlight, once again, the idea that Jewish education, connection with the tradition, might be the way that keep people in the fold.
Well, I think those birthright Israel is not saying that don't need Jewish education.
Right.
It's hardly an age where...
There's no question, but I don't have all my facts about the program. The way some people write about it is, you get 3 weeks at the beach, all expenses paid. Other people talk about the fact that there is an educational component built into the program as well, and it can lead to other things. Now, I think on balance, better to do something than do nothing. That's always so. But the question is this the optimal vehicle of investment? Meaning, are there alternative investments? With a finite resource, could the money better be used for other purposes? So the jury is out on it. We'll have to see. It's a relatively new program. There's certainly no question that one could point to hundreds, if not thousands, of Jewish people that have been immensely inspired by their connection to the State of Israel, and it's often led to other things, other involvements in life. So who knows? Okay. But anyway, this was just a long digression to illustrate the significance of Gershon, Kahath, and Merari, even after we enter the land of Israel. Now, this brings us to chapter 22, and these are the last three chapters in the book of Yehoshua. And there's a certain kind of formality. What is the phrase? I don't remember the phrase. At the end of a war, the army gathers together, and then they're formally discharged. They're said, "Now you can go home," whatever it is. And the book began, if you recall, with a summons to Reuven, Gad, and half of the tribe of Manasseh, who already had their homes, already had their territory, east of the Jordan. And Yehoshua reminded them of their solemn oath to Moshe that they would continue to fight on behalf of their brethren, go home to their families, until the war was completed. And that's the beginning of the book. And at the very end of the book, there's a whole ceremony here where Moshe, as it were, addresses the tribe of Reuven, Gad, and Chatzi Shevet Manasseh, and he praises them and he reminds them that they have faithfully discharged their duty and they are now permitted to go home. Now, this is very important. Why is it so important to memorialize this? Because basically, you can understand that in the course of historical times, people may not have a recollection of what happened, and the accusation may surface that these Reuven and Gad people did not help fight. So Yehoshua had it memorialized as an official act that they were officially given authorization to go home because they have fought in accordance with their promise, etc. All right. Now, the next part of the parak mentions a very unusual thing, a potential civil war. And we're not told how many years after they went home this happened. And that is, that in Eivor HaYardei, the children of Reuven, Gad, and Chatzi Shevet Menashe built a huge altar. And the Jewish people on the West Bank were incensed. Now, what did they think? They assumed that this was an act of cessation, because after all, the place of central worship, which was the Mishkan, was located in Shilom, which is now, you know, West Bank settlement. They now built their own altar, which indicates, as it were, an attempt to create their own central place of worship, perhaps with the intention of seceding. And therefore, they wanted to declare war, very analogous to the American Civil War, in order to prevent this event from occurring. And the details of that are given in somewhat great detail. But there was a misunderstanding, apparently, and the two and a half tribes stated that they did not build this as a functioning altar. They built this as a memorial. And the purpose of the memorial is to remember. In other words, it's really the opposite. We build ourselves a replica of the altar to show that we have a share in that altar that's in the West Bank, meaning it was not to use, but it was to affirm our connection, and as a result, the civil war was averted. So again, we're not given a lot of details here other than saying that 10 of the tribes were ready to engage in war to destroy that secessionist impulse, and that was only averted either, well, again, I'm not sure, you know, you can understand this two ways. Was this a misunderstanding, or did Reuven and Gad and Chatzi Shevet Menashe change their story when they're confronted with the threat? It could very well be, because if you think about it, it's a little peculiar. Why would they build an altar if they're not planning to bring any sacrifice? They may go, well, it's just an altar. We're not planning on bringing any korbanot. So why an altar? Why not a statue or something else? So perhaps under the pressure of the 10 tribes, perhaps they did redefine what they were doing. But nevertheless, it did become a monument of sorts, a monument to the fact that this group did valiantly, kind of a war monument, valiantly contribute to the military effort. And you can see that obviously the fear would be that in the course of time, the separation might be great. Now, in point of fact, historically, as the Jewish history developed in the Bible, we do not find that the East Bank of the Yarden ever became a separate empire. We have the Northern Kingdom and the Southern Kingdom, and of course Transjordan belonged to the Northern Kingdom, the 10 tribes. But they never formed a separate autonomous unit of their own. And apparently, at this early stage, there was a real fear that that would have happened. But just again, just as the Civil War ended, the secessionist impulse that seemed to have worked here as well. Okay, so that takes us to the last two prakim, and both of them involve speeches. The last two chapters are two different farewell speeches of Yehoshua. Let's find something here. Yeah, speech number one reminds the Jewish people of all the miracles that God has done for them. It is calling upon them to keep the Torah. If you look at verse 6, V'chazakten miyod lishmor v'lasot et kol ha-katur b'sefer Torah Moshe. You should strengthen yourself to observe all that is written in the book of the Torah of Moshe. Lebilti sur mimenu, not to turn away from it. Yamin usmo, to the right or to the left. Now this, of course, is the exact wording the Torah uses in many places. And although I don't think that that's the meaning, it is tempting to identify right and left with their more modern usages. Meaning to say, we talk about right as a more conservative, strict interpretation, and left as a liberal. So when the Torah says, do not go to the right and do not go to the left, it's indicating that one should not be extreme in their stringency of interpretation, and one should certainly not be extreme in their liberality of interpretation. One should seek out the middle ground. He warns them against idolatry. He warns them against intermarriage. He warns them against treaties with the nations that could lead to this type of assimilation. And he calls upon them to cleave unto God. And he says that if they do make relationships with the nations in a manner that is a violation of the Torah, then those nations shall eventually be a stumbling block and an obstacle in their lives, and will eventually result in galut. Okay, so basically it's somewhat similar to the farewell speeches of Moshe at the end of the Torah. Yahushua does the same type of thing at the end of his life, calling upon them to keep the Torah, to avoid entanglements. Again, we'll have to deal with similar to George Washington's farewell address. Avoid excessive entanglements with the Umot HaOlam, because they shall bring you down and bring you away from God and result in galuts. Now, then there's a second speech that he gives, and I want to read some verses here, because the second speech actually is incorporated in the Passover Haggadah. That is, look at chapter 24. Vayasof Yehoshua et kol shiftei Yisrael shechama. Yehoshua gathered all of the Jewish people to the city of Shechem. Vayikra lezikne Yisrael ulrashav ulshavtav ulshavtav. He calls the elders, the heads, the judges, the shotrim are the law enforcers. Vayityatzvu lifnei Elokim, and they stand assembled in the presence of God. Now, Pasuk Bet. If you have a good memory for the Pesach Haggadah, you will recognize this Pasuk. Vayomer Yehoshua el kol ha'am. And Yehoshua said to all of the people, Kol amar Hashem Elokei Yisrael. So says God, the God of Israel. Be'ever hanahar yashvu avotechem. The other side of the river, that means east of the Euphrates, is where your forefathers came from. In other words, we're not indigenous to the land of Israel. We come from Babylonia. Terach, who was the father of Abraham, and he was the father of Nahor. Actually, just to remind us of the biblical genealogy, Terach had three sons. Terach had a son, Abraham, who was called Avram then. He had a son, Nahor. He had a son, Haran. Not Haran, Haran. Haran was the city. Now, what happened was this, though. Haran died early. Haran died in Babylonia. The Chumash says that. Haran had two children, Sarah and Lot. It's interesting, right? So, Avraham married his niece. Avram married Haran, and Lot was Sarah's brother.
How about Milcah?
Milcah, yeah, Milcah, that's right. Nahor, yeah, Milcah is Sarah's sister. And Nahor married Milcah. So what happened was, Avraham and Nahor married the two daughters of Haran. Okay, everyone following? Therefore, now Milcah had a son, Betuel. And Betuel, of course, had a daughter, Rivka, and Lavan was the brother, right? So they're all related in many, many ways. Now, what happened was this. The reason why it says only the father of Avraham and the father of Nahor, because only Avraham and Nahor left Babylonia. Nahor stayed in Haran, stayed in Mesopotamia, and Avraham came. Haran died early. Now, the rabbinic tradition is why Haran died early is that Avraham was thrown into a furnace by King Nimrod because he refused to worship idols. And Avraham survived the furnace. And Haran was also asked if he believed in God or not. And Haran's response was, well, let me just see what happens to Avraham. If Avraham gets burnt, I'll believe in the idols. And if Avraham doesn't get burnt, I'll go with Avraham. And Avraham was saved, so Haran became a believer. He discovered religion. And says, I also believe, in God. He got thrown into the furnace and he died because you have to believe because you believe, not because you see miracles. So there was Terech was the father of Abram, the father of Nachor. Vayavdu Elohim Acherim, and they worshipped idols. Vo'ekach es avichem es Avraham mi'Avraham Nahar, and I took your forefather Abraham from the other side of the river. V'yoleich oto b'chol eretz Canaan, I brought him throughout the land of Canaan. Right, this is in the Haggadah. V'yarba et Zaro, and I increased his children, because he gave him one child, Yatinglo et Yitzchak. Again, it does not mention Yishmael, because Yoshua is describing the formation of the Jewish people. V'yatinglo Yitzchak et Yaakov v'yat Esav, v'yatinglo Esav et Har Seir l'reshet oto, I gave Esav Mount Seir, Yaakov Ubanav, Yordu Mitzrayim. Yaakov and his children came down to Zion. If you recall, these three verses, Pasuk Bet, Gimel, and Dalet, are actually incorporated in the Pesach Haggadah, because there's a little part of the Pesach Haggadah which goes backwards, meaning it gives us a little bit of our history before going into Egypt. And that is the story of Hashem taking Abraham. Now, it's interesting, though, that the rest of the chapter continues the story, and you would have figured, why not have this in the Haggadah? It's even more relevant. Because then it says, and you were in Egypt, and I sent Moshe, and I sent Aaron, and there were the 10 plagues, and there was the splitting of the Red Sea. So you would think, why does the Haggadah specifically end the incorporation of this narrative when it talks about the exodus of Egypt? Like it cuts it off at the wrong place. So there's actually very interesting thoughts that is said about this. And that is, you know, one of the most notable omissions in the Haggadah of Pesach is the name of Moshe. Moshe's name, it actually is mentioned once in the Haggadah, but it's mentioned in the middle of a verse. In other words, in the middle of the Red Sea, it says, they believed in Moshe and in God. Or they believed in God and in Moshe and his servant. That's one reference. And that's talking about the Red Sea, but in the actual Exodus story. Meaning, the Haggadah had to be pretty smart to keep on quoting verses about the Exodus and unearthing verses that make no mention of Moshe. Well, if you'll notice that in verse 5, which talks about Yitziat Mitzrayim, it says, I sent Moshe and Aaron. And Yoshua's account very heavily emphasizes Moshe's role. Therefore, the Baalei Haggadah did not incorporate this series of verses because of their deliberate decision to de-emphasize in the narrative of the Passover Haggadah the role of Moshe Rabbeinu. And that's why it specifically stops the narrative at the point where Moshe's name is mentioned. Now, why does the Haggadah want to de-emphasize the role of Moshe Rabbeinu? So there are a lot of reasons. Pesach night, we glorify the name of Hashem. We don't want to ascribe redemption to a human being. There was a fear that Moshe could be somehow deified, turned into a godlike figure. In fact, that is why some commentaries say it was the divine plan that Moshe would be a stutterer, so people would not be overwhelmed by charismatic, you know, hypnotic speaking ability. They would see that he was human, as holy and as great as he was. So consequently, the Haggadah totally de-emphasizes the role. Although Yoshua does not, and as we see very often, Yoshua constantly invokes the image of Moshe. Number one, because in a very vivid way, many people still remembered Moshe. And number two, it legitimizes his own leadership because it connects him in that unbroken line to Moshe Rabbeinu. In other words, he's always going to connect that, right? Even Gore, you know, if Gore would have connected himself more to Clinton, maybe he would have won, you know, who knows. But the point is, sometimes connecting yourself to the leader gives you a certain amount of influence that you wouldn't have if you sever that connection. Now, I will tell you a beautiful Hasidic thought. If you remember, the Haggadah emphasizes that God took us out of Egypt, and it says, Ani v'lo malach, I am not an angel. Ani v'lo saraf, I am not a saraf, it's also a burning angel. Ani v'lo hashaliach, I and not an emissary. So it's interesting that it's pointed out in the Hasidic books that if you take the first letter of those three words, I and not a malach, mem, I and not a sarach, shin, sin, which is a shin, I and not the shaliach, hey, in fact, it shouldn't even say, it shouldn't say an evil shaliach, is hey, mem, shin, hey, meaning it was I and not Moshe. So there is an indirect allusion to Moshe in malach, sarach, and ha-shaliach. Right? So what Yeshua is doing is the following, that in his first farewell speech, Yeshua emphasizes general values, values of closeness to God, keeping the Torah, not getting into excessive entanglements with Yumot HaOlam, which could bring you down in your mitzvot. In the second farewell speech, he grounds his observations in historical experience. Okay, so he doesn't just say, be good and keep the Torah, but he reminds them, remember your history, remember where you come from, remember all that God has done for you, not only in taking you out of Egypt, which is physical redemption, but in taking you out of Ur Kasdim, out of Babylonia, to give you a holy land and give you an opportunity to serve him. So basically he's saying not merely in general terms keeping the mitzvot, but he's grounding the Shmirat HaMitzvot in the historical experiences of the Jewish people. He even brings in Balak and Bilam, right? That you know that a few years ago, wasn't that many years ago, at least from the perspective of Yeshua, Bilam was hired to curse the Jews. And God turned that klala into a bracha. Now, again, let me digress for a second just to share a very interesting thought about Bilam. Bilam, of course, was the great sorcerer. He was half curse, will travel. That people would hire him to curse nations, and somehow his curses took effect. They seemed to work. And he commanded a high price. It's very interesting that Bilam, it is said, was really a professional mercenary in that sense. Meaning to say, if the Jews would have hired him to go against the Moabites, he would have gone with them. Meaning, whoever pays him, you know, gets his services. In fact, the word Bilam, some suggest, comes from Bili'az, a person without a nation. He had no allegiance. He was a hired gun. He would go wherever he was paid. Now, what happened was that Bilam went, and three times he wanted to utter a curse against the Jewish people. And God changed his curse into the blessing. And of course you have the famous scene with Bilam's donkey talking to him, etc. Now the thing is this, there is a rabbinic tradition that Bilam's great success was that there's a certain second of the day in which divine wrath is ready to be expressed on the world. And if you know when to curse during that particular second, you tap and you open the faucet of boiling water, let's say, and it all comes out. So Bilam knew the exact second of divine wrath. So the question is raised, yeah, but if it only lasts a second or a fraction of a second, what is it that you could say that would be completed within that second? Like, what could you do? So Tosfos says, you could have said the word kalem, kalem with a chaf, destroy them, kalem. That could have been done in a moment. So again, just to express a thought from Sifrei Chassidut, they say the following. Kalem means destroy them, kale otam. But allegorically, it could be understood as an abbreviation. The kaf is kalayot, the kidneys. The lamed is lev, the heart. And the mem is moach, the mind. What does that mean? The kidneys are always identified as the seat of passion, particularly sexual passion. The lev is emotion. The moach, the mind, is identified with intellect and moral sensibility. The greatest curse a person could have is that their kidneys and their heart control their minds, meaning to say they are victimized by their passions and desires and don't have the wherewithal of self-control and self-discipline and self-direction. So the real cursing of a person is, may you be a person whose kidneys control their mind. Now, the opposite of that, moach lev kliyot, the mind controls the kidneys and the heart, spells melech, the king. That the true meaning of a king is not one who rules over others, but one who can rule over themselves. Self-mastery. And therefore, when it says, God reversed the curse of Bilam and made it a bracha, he took the kaleh and it turned into giving us the capacity of malchut, of melech. And that's why you find in Bilam's blessings, there are many uses of the word melech, kingship. And that's kingship. Kingship is the glory of self-control. In fact, it's very interesting. I once heard an explanation. You know, we say that human beings have free will. How do you define free will? What's free will? That's a great gift, free will. So people say, well, free will is you can do what you decide, what you want to do. So this person said, no. Free will is when you can decide to do what you don't want to do. He says, free will is that you have the discipline and the strength that even if you want to do something, you sometimes know you can't do it. And even if you don't want to do something, you sometimes know you have to do it. So free will is not doing what you want. It's not doing what you want. That's the true freedom. Because even an animal, when an animal wants to do something, it does it. There's no restraint. And this is an important idea that the truth is, you know, we talk about building self-esteem in children and all those things. But the true origin of self-esteem is when a person does develop that capacity of control and discipline. And that's a source of real pride in a person. A person can really take pride in that accomplishment, as opposed to simply being allowed to do whatever you want to do. It does not build a sense of self-respect in a person.
I lost you.
Yeah.
You said Kaleo Tami destroyed them. You talked about the kidneys, the heart, the mind.
Yes.
Where did the mem come from?
Moach. No. Okay. Kalei is moach, the brain.
Oh, Kalei.
Right. So all I'm saying is, if you simply reverse Kalei, you get melech. Right? So to live in a certain way is destruction, and to live in another way is royalty. Right? So that's the idea of Bilam. It's not a medrash. This is actually a thought much, much later. A thought from the Sfat Emet, which is one of the Hasidic writers. So he died in 1900, so 19th century, basically. Yeah, it's a much later idea. But, let me be clear about that. The statement that Bilam's curse was the word kalem, without giving the meaning of it, is contained in Tosfot and Tractate Brachot. But the idea of the abbreviation is Tzvatemet. Yeah. Okay. But then he brings the Bilam, etc. And then once again, based on this history, he once again calls upon the Jewish people to obey. But Yoshua in chapter 24 employs kind of an unusual sarcasm, which is, I think, unusual in these types of talks. He basically says, if you look at verse 15, this is chapter 24, verse 15. He says, if it is evil in your eyes to worship God, then choose today who you want to worship. Do you want to worship the gods that your forefathers used to worship on the other side of the river? Go with them, whether it's the ancient idolatry of Terah, or maybe the gods of the Amorites? Why don't you go with them? Because he seems to be giving them a choice. Why don't you go out there? Me and my house and myself, however, we will stay with God. And then it says, V'yad ha'am. And the people answer. And you'll notice it says in Lashon Yachid. Just like Matan Torah. Ish echad v'lev echad. Cholil olanu mi'azov et Hashem. God forbid that we should forsake God. God is so good, etc. God did this and that. And then look at verse 19, where Joshua says, well, you know, worshiping God is too hard. Why don't you go for an easier way of doing it? But Yom HaShua, you can't worship God. Ki Elokim Kedoshim Hu. He is so holy. Kel Kanohu. He is a zealous God, a God that is jealous. Lo Yisa Lepishachem. He will not forgive your sins. In other words, it's reminiscent of the Tom Sawyer strategy, meaning to say, by somehow telling a person you can't have something, that increases their desire. Yeshua is saying, this isn't for you, this is too difficult. You can't live up to this. And of course, this brings up their desire. He says, no, 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 we want to do it, we want to do it, we want to do it. And they says, Hashem Navot. And then Yeshua said to them, so I want you to be witnesses today that you have chosen this. I have not forced it upon you. I gave you, of course, we don't really know what type of choice this was. I mean, let's say they would have said, we chose not to keep the Torah. I mean, you know, it's not like there was a real choice here. But by phrasing it as a choice, Yeshua says, you have chosen it. This has been your decision. And now you must live up to it. And a covenant was entered into, similar to the covenant of Matan Torah, and then he sent the people off. So basically, the content of the two speeches are similar, except that the second speech, number one, connects it to the history of the Jewish people, and number two, emphasizes the voluntary nature of this undertaking, reminiscent of Matan Torah, where the Jewish people said, Na'aseh v'nishma, and we are told Yeshua went home. He died at 110, interestingly enough. He did not quite replicate Moshe. Moshe had the 120. Yeshua was a little less. And the Pasuk tells us that the Jewish people continued to serve God all the days of Yeshua and all the days of the elders whose lives overlapped with Yeshua. So until the last elder that was in Yeshua's lifetime died, the Jewish people did keep the mitzvot. And then Pasuk Lamed Bet tells us that the bones of Yosef were buried in the city of Shechem. Of course, as you know, unfortunately, that was the tomb of Yosef that was desecrated in the city of Shechem, but that is the place where Yosef is buried. Yosef is not buried in the cave of Machpelah. He's not buried in Hebron. And it finally ends that when Yeshua died, Elazar, the son of Aaron, the second Kohen Gadol, died as well. And he was buried in the property of Pinchas, his son. Pinchas was already alive in the Torah's time, but Pinchas remained alive for many more years. In fact, according to many Midrashim, Pinchas became Eliyahu HaNavi, who never died. So Pinchas and Eliyahu are... So Eliyahu HaNavi is a Kohen. That's why the Arabs have a tradition like that as well. You know, overlooking the Mount of Olives, you have the wall of the Old City, and you have what is called the Golden Gate, that is the sealed up gate that would go to the Temple Mount. And there is a tradition that Mashiach will come, will enter Yerushalayim through that Golden Gate by going down from the Mount of Olives through the Valley of Yehoshaphat and up that little hill to the Golden Gate. Now, the Arabs know that Mashiach cannot come till Eliyahu HaNavi announces his coming. They also know, in the Midrash, that Eliyahu HaNavi is a Kohen, Pinchas, and they also know that a Kohen cannot go through a cemetery. Therefore, there is a little Islam, Muslim cemetery adjacent to the Golden Gate, right? You know, you see it there? And they feel that this way they will stop Eliyahu from announcing Mashiach, and therefore Mashiach will not come. Again, I would assume that under... Even if they would find some other way of coming, I mean, we're not going to say that cemetery is going to stop it. But halachically, the reason it fails is that a Kohen is allowed to walk through a non-Jewish cemetery. And therefore, Eliyahu HaNavi would be allowed to go through that particular area. So that they're not quite complete for. All right, so this is our story of Yehoshua. Yeah.
I just want to comment that his whole speech there, giving him that choice, I think it just shows also his oratory ability and maybe saying something about that being a factor in leadership.
Yeah, I think that's true. I mean, one could imagine. I mean, imagine the scene. One can imagine how stirred up and how emotional people will get when he says, you don't want this, you don't want this, you go do something else. And people cry out and scream, we want it, please let us have it. And this was it. He was actually stirring them up. Now, Moshe Rabbeinu himself was not an orator, but Moshe himself did not use this particular technique. Although it's interesting, the one figure that I recall in Tanakh who does use the technique is Eliyahu HaNavi at Mount Carmel. He has a similar type of talk. So it's interesting that maybe, it mentions Elazar and Yeshua, maybe Pinchas absorbed it all the way back from Yeshua, because Moshe Rabbeinu did not talk that way, with that kind of sarcasm, and to build up the demand by saying you can't have it. This seems to be what Yeshua did. Yeah. Okay, so we'll stop here for now. Maybe I'll just in a few minutes just tell you a thought about Hanukkah. And then, God willing, January 18th, was it?
Mm-hmm.
We'll begin the book of Shmuel. We'll try to go through that. I just want to share a thought about Hanukkah. We know that, of course, Hanukkah begins tonight. And Hanukkah is 8 days. And all of us know that there is an argument between Beit Shammai and Beit Hillel. How does one celebrate the Hanukkah? That according to Beit Shammai, the first night you will light 8 candles and go down. And according to Beit Hillel, which we of course follow, we start with 1 and we add every day. Now, another thing that is interesting is the famous question. That is, they found enough oil to burn for 1 day, and it burned for 8 days. So the miracle of the oil was only 7 days. There was no miracle that the oil burned the first day, because there wasn't enough oil for 1 day. So one of the famous questions, this is a very, very famous question, is Hanukkah ought to be celebrated only 7 days and not 8 days? Now, there are at least 500 answers to this question, because I've seen books that have 500 answers to this question, so there might be more. But just to go through this, I once heard, let me answer the second question first, then I'll go back to Shammai and Hillel. I once heard a beautiful explanation from the chief rabbi of Israel, Rabbi Lau, the Ashkenazic chief rabbi. And his story. As a young child, he was in a concentration camp. He was 4 years old. And, the Nazis would not allow kids of that age to live. But his brother hid him in a sack. And he kept him in a bag all day or something. I don't know exactly how that even worked. And he said, it was a tremendous miracle that the Nazis never looked into the bag. Because if they would have looked, they would have found him. But the miracle is, they didn't look. So sometimes there's a miracle that you don't look, because if you look, you'll find. He says, the miracle of the Jewish people was that they bothered to look for the oil. Meaning, they come after a war, everything is destroyed, everything is ruined, and yet they're so concerned with the ability to serve God properly that they look for that little bit of oil. So he says, the miracle of the first day is not that once they found the oil, it burnt. But the miracle is they cared enough to try to look. And that's an amazing story, because what is Hanukkah about? Hanukkah is not just celebrating this miracle of oil. I mean, big deal. I mean, it was a miracle, but rather Hanukkah is really a metaphor, because the world is filled with darkness on many levels. There is the darkness of assimilation, of ignorance, of evil. The darkness of depression, the darkness of illness, the darkness of loneliness. And each of us has a capacity to shed some light and dispel some of this darkness. But sometimes our feeling is, what's the use? The darkness is so great, and whatever little light we light is going to go out very quickly. They could have said that as well, meaning if they need 8 days, and they only have 1 day, their rational response might be, why bother to light it today? It's going to go out tomorrow. But what do you see? You do whatever light you can do, and then God blesses the efforts beyond that which you thought was possible. So the message of Hanukkah is that in a world and in a life sometimes that is filled with darkness, a person must strive to generate whatever light they're able to generate, even if it seems hopeless, irrational, fruitless, and it won't accomplish anything. You never know what God will do to the light that you try to generate. And that's why it's really, it's funny, there's now a bit of a movement around to de-emphasize Hanukkah. It's interesting because, the December Dilemma issue, which for many years required that Hanukkah be built up to Christmas in importance. So now you see that it's important that Jews understand that Hanukkah is not the equivalent. Certainly it is. But in that attempt, there's almost a counter-reaction now to say, Hanukkah is extremely unimportant. I mean, I actually see that writing. It is unimportant, you know, it should not be equated. And that's too bad, because Hanukkah is extremely important. You know, Hanukkah is about how to live in a culture with the pressures of assimilation, because we remember that although Antiochus enforced his decrees upon pain of death, but it wasn't like a Hitler situation where he wanted to eradicate the Jewish people. Rather, he wanted the Jewish people to give up their distinctive way of life and simply become citizens of the Hellenic Empire. And if you go along with that, everything would be fine. Right? So Hanukkah does deal with how do we survive living in a culture which has so many pressures to abandon that which is distinctively Jewish. And the metaphor is one of darkness and the ability of light to vanquish darkness. And it is the message of not giving up, meaning to say, even if we think that our light is so small and so meaningless that it's not going to make a difference, you've got to persevere. And really, it's that idea of the light overcoming the darkness, just like the small group of people overcame the great numbers. It's all the same. In the Alma Nisim, the small against the many, the little bit of light against the darkness, it's all the same. So with this, we can go back to the machloket, Beit Shammai and Beit Hillel, regarding whether you start with 8 and go down, or start with 7. Because the light of Hanukkah has a dual imagery. It is symbolic of the divine light that comes and blesses the world, but it's also symbolic of the human soul. A human soul is called the candle of God. And in this sense, fire also has two images. Fire is that which destroys and burns, and fire is that which gives warmth and illumination. Beit Shammai looks at man's struggle in the world as defeating evil. And therefore his image of fire is burn away the evil that is within and without. So consequently, his trajectory of spiritual perfection is the evil should get diminished as time goes by, both within yourself and without yourself. So Beit Shammai says, identify 8 things you got to correct, burn them away one by one by one by one. So day 1 you got 8 things you got to destroy, day 2 you got only 7 things, etc. Because he's viewing the process of spiritual growth as attacking the evil, the selfishness, the egotism, the cruelty, burning it away. Beit Hillel, however, says that might be the appropriate method of tshuva, a righteous person who could confront, right? A person could look at his flaws and say, I'll work on them one by one. But Beit Hillel says, realistically for many people, that becomes a self-defeating proposition because we get depressed, we get upset, we get discouraged. So Beit Hillel says, instead of confronting your dark side directly, build on your strengths, generate warmth and light, do the mitzvot that you are attracted to, and that will give you reservoirs of light and strength which will automatically defeat the evil within. And that is the pattern of adding candles, meaning we're not using fire as the vehicle to frontally confront and destroy the negative, but we're using fire as the vehicle that builds and accentuates the positive. And Beit Hillel says the best way for a light to defeat darkness is not by fighting the darkness, but by generating the light. And therefore Beit Shammai and Beit Hillel are discussing two models of spiritual transformation and growth. Is it the model of focusing on my flaws and overcoming them? Or is it the model of building on my strengths and capitalizing on them? One will have a pattern of going down, because your flaws should be improved as you're going through life, and the other has the model of generating more warmth and light. So, again, I wish you all a very, very happy and joyous Hanukkah.
You too.
And God willing, we'll begin the book of Shmuel January 18th.
Thank you.
Thanks a lot. Thank you. Again, if anyone is interested in going to Israel with me, you know, there's still some openings.
Right.
Is it? For the election, okay.
When
okay.
is it?
We'll see. When is the election? I don't know.
No,
when
are
they no my tour is from December 31st to January 9th. Yes, sir.
Yeah,
okay.
You're done with